This is Audible.
Listening Library presents We Are Okay by Nina LaCour. Read for you by Georgina Marie. For Kristen, more now than ever, and in memory of my grandfather, Joseph LaCour, forever in my heart. Chapter 1. Before Hannah left, she asked if I was sure I'd be okay. She had already waited an hour past when the doors were closed for winter break, until everyone but the custodians were gone. She had folded a load of laundry, written an email, searched her massive psychology textbook for answers to the final exam questions to see if she had gotten them right. She had run out of ways to fill time. So when I said, "Yes, I'll be fine," she had nothing left to do except try to believe me. I helped her carry a bag downstairs. She gave me a hug, tight and official, and said, "We'll be back from my aunt's on the 28th. Take the train down, and we'll go to shows." I said yes, not knowing if I meant it. When I returned to our room, I found she'd snuck a sealed envelope onto my pillow. And now I'm alone in the building, staring at my name written in Hannah's pretty cursive, trying to not let this tiny object undo me. I have a thing about envelopes, I guess. I don't want to open it. I don't really even want to touch it. But I keep telling myself that it will only be something nice, a Christmas card. Maybe with a special message inside. Maybe with nothing but a signature. Whatever it is, it will be harmless. The dorms are closed for the month-long semester break, but my advisor helped me arrange to stay here. The administration wasn't happy about it. "Don't you have any family?" they kept asking. "What about friends you can stay with?" "This is where I live now," I told them. "Where I will live until I graduate." Eventually, they surrendered. A note from the residential services manager appeared under my door a couple days ago, saying the groundskeeper would be here throughout the holiday, giving me his contact information. "Anything at all," she wrote. "Contact him if you need anything at all." Things I need. The California sunshine. A more convincing smile. Without everyone's voices, the TVs in their rooms, the faucets running and toilets flushing, the hums and dings of the microwaves, the footsteps and the doors slamming. Without all of the sounds of living, this building is a new and strange place. I've been here for 3 months, but I hadn't noticed the sound of the heater until now. It clicks on, a gust of warmth. I'm alone tonight. Tomorrow, Mabel will arrive and stay for 3 days, and then I'll be alone again until the middle of January. "If I were spending a month alone," Hannah said yesterday, "I would start a meditation practice. It's clinically proven to lower blood pressure and boost brain activity. It even helps your immune system." A few minutes later, she pulled a book out of her backpack. "I saw this in the bookstore the other day. You can read it first if you want." She tossed it on my bed. An essay collection on solitude. I know why she's afraid for me. I first appeared in this doorway 2 weeks after Gramps died. I stepped in, a stunned and feral stranger. And now I'm someone she knows, and I need to stay that way. For her, and for me. Only an hour in and already the first temptation. The warmth of my blankets and bed, my pillows and the fake fur throw Hannah's mom left here after a weekend visit. They're all saying, "Climb in. No one will know if you stay in bed all day. No one will know if you wear the same sweatpants for the entire month. If you eat every meal in front of television shows and use t-shirts as napkins. Go ahead and listen to that same song on repeat until its sound turns to nothing and you sleep the winter away." I only have Mabel's visit to get through. And then all this could be mine. I could scroll through Twitter until my vision blurs and then collapse on my bed like an Oscar Wilde character. I could score myself a bottle of whiskey, though I promised Gramps I wouldn't, and let it make me glow. Let all the room's edges go soft. Let the memories out of their cages. Maybe I would hear him sing again, if all else went quiet. But this is what Hannah's trying to save me from. The collection of essays is Indigo, paperback. I open to the epigraph, a quote by Wendell Berry. In the circle of the human, we are weary with striving and are without rest. My particular circle of the human has fled the biting cold for the houses of their parents, for crackling fireplaces or tropical destinations where they will pose in bikinis and Santa hats to wish their friends a Merry Christmas. I will do my best to trust Mr. Berry and see their absence as an opportunity. The first essay is on nature, by a writer I've never heard of who spends pages describing a lake. For the first time in a long time, I relax into a description of setting. He describes ripples, the glint of light against water, tiny pebbles on the shore. He moves on to buoyancy and weightlessness. These are things I understand. I would brave the cold outside if I had a key to the indoor pool. If I could begin and end each day of this solitary month by swimming laps, I would feel so much better. But I can't. So I read on. He's suggesting that we think about nature as a way to be alone. He says lakes and forests reside in our minds. Close your eyes, he says, and go there. I close my eyes. The heater clicks off. I wait to see what will fill me. Slowly it comes. Sand. Beach grass and beach glass. Gulls and sanderlings. The sound, and then, faster, the sight of waves crashing in, pulling back, disappearing into ocean and sky. I open my eyes. It's too much. The moon is a bright sliver out my window. My desk lamp, shining on a piece of scratch paper, is the only light on in all 100 rooms of this building. I'm making a list for after Mabel leaves. Read the New York Times online each morning, buy groceries, make soup, ride the bus to the shopping district / library / cafe, read about solitude, meditate, watch documentaries, listen to podcasts, find new music. I fill the electric kettle in the bathroom sink and then make myself top ramen. While eating, I download an audiobook on meditation for beginners. I press play. My mind wanders. Later, I try to sleep, but the thoughts keep coming. Everything's swirling together. Hannah talking about meditation and Broadway shows. The groundskeeper and if I will need something from him. Mabel somehow arriving here where I live now. Somehow making herself a part of my life again. I don't even know how I will form the word, hello. I don't know what I will do with my face, if I will be able to smile, or even if I should. And through all of this is the heater, clicking on and off, louder and louder the more tired I become. I turn on my bedside lamp and pick up the book of essays. I could try the exercise again and stay on solid ground this time. I remember redwood trees so monumental it took 5 of us, fully grown, with arms outstretched, to encircle just one of them. Beneath the trees were ferns and flowers and damp, black dirt. But I don't trust my mind to stay in that redwood grove. And right now, outside and covered in snow, are trees I've never wrapped my arms around. In this place, my history only goes 3 months back. I'll start here. I climb out of bed and pull a pair of sweats over my leggings, a bulky sweater over my turtleneck. I drag my desk chair to my door, and then down the hall to the elevator, where I push the button for the top floor. Once the elevator doors open, I carry the chair to the huge arched window of the tower, where it's always quiet, even when the dorm is full. There I sit, with my palms on my knees, my feet flat on the carpet. Outside is the moon, the contours of trees, the buildings of the campus, the lights that dot the path. All of this is my home now, and it will still be my home after Mabel leaves. I'm taking in the stillness of that, the sharp truth of it. My eyes are burning. My throat is tight. If only I had something to take the edge off the loneliness. If only lonely were a more accurate word. It should sound much less pretty. Better to face this now, though, so that it doesn't take me by surprise later, so that I don't find myself paralyzed and unable to feel my way back to myself. I breathe in. I breathe out. I keep my eyes open to these new trees. I know where I am and what it means to be here. I know Mabel is coming tomorrow, whether I want her to or not. I know that I am always alone, even when surrounded by people. So I let the emptiness in. The sky is the darkest blue, each star clear and bright. My palms are warm on my legs. There are many ways of being alone. That's something I know to be true. I breathe in stars and sky. I breathe out snow and trees. There are many ways of being alone. And the last time wasn't like this. Morning feels different. I slept until almost 10 when I heard the groundskeeper's truck on the drive below my room, clearing the snow. I'm showered and dressed now. My window lets in daylight. I choose a playlist and plug Hannah's speakers into my computer. Soon, an acoustic guitar strum fills the room, followed by a woman's voice. Electric kettle in hand, I prop open my door on the way to the bathroom sink. The song follows me around the corner. I leave the bathroom door open, too. As long as I'm their only inhabitant, I should make these spaces feel more like mine. Water fills the kettle. I look at my reflection while I wait. I try to smile in the way I should when Mabel arrives. A smile that conveys as much welcome as regret. A smile with meaning behind it. One that says all I need to say to her so I don't have to form the right words. I shut off the faucet. Back in my room, I plug in the kettle and pick up my yellow bowl from where it rests, tipped over to dry, from last night. I pour in granola and the rest of the milk from the tiny fridge wedged between Hannah's desk and mine. I'll be drinking my breakfast tea black this morning. In 7.5 hours, Mabel will arrive. I cross to the doorway to see the room as she'll see it. Thankfully, Hannah's brought some color into it, but it only takes a moment to notice the contrast between her side and mine. Other than my plant and the bowls, even my desk is bare. I sold back all of last semester's textbooks 2 days ago, and I don't really want her to see the book on solitude. I slip it into my closet. There's plenty of room. And when I turn back, I'm faced with the worst part of all. my bulletin board, without a single thing on it. I may not be able to do much about my smile, but I can do something about this. I've been in enough other dorm rooms to know what to do. I've spent plenty of time looking at Hannah's wall. I need quotes from songs and books and celebrities. I need photographs and souvenirs, concert ticket stubs, evidences of inside jokes. Most of these are things I don't have, but I can do my best with pens and paper and the printer Hannah and I share. There's a song Hannah and I have been listening to in the mornings. I write the chorus from memory in purple pen, and then cut the paper in a square around the words. I spend a long time online choosing a picture of the moon. Keaton, who lives two doors down, has been teaching us all about crystals. She has a collection on her windowsill, always sparkling with light. I find the blog of a woman named Josephine, who explains the healing properties of gemstones and how to use them. I find images of pyrite, for protection, hematite, for grounding, jade, for serenity. Our color printer clicks and whirs. I regret selling my textbooks back so soon. I had sticky notes and faint pencil scrawls on so many of the pages. In history, we learned about the arts and crafts movement, and there were all these ideas I liked. I search for William Morris, read essay after essay, trying to find my favorite of his quotes. I copy a few of them down, using a different color pen for each. I print them out, too, in various fonts, in case they'll look better typed. I search for a redwood tree that resembles my memories and end up watching a mini-documentary on redwood ecosystems, in which I learned that during the summertime, California redwoods gather most of their water from the fog, and that they provide homes to clouded salamanders, who have no lungs and breathe through their skin. I press print on a picture of a clouded salamander on bright green moss, and once the printer stops, I think I have enough. I borrow a handful of Hannah's pushpins and arrange everything I've printed and written, and then step back and look. Everything is too crisp. Too new. Each paper is the same white. It doesn't matter that the quotes are interesting and pictures are pretty. It looks desperate. And now it's almost 3 already, and I've wasted these hours, and it's becoming difficult to breathe because 6:30 is no longer far in the future. Mabel knows me better than anyone else in the world, even though we haven't spoken at all in these 4 months. Most of her texts to me went unanswered, until eventually she stopped sending them. I don't know how her Los Angeles life is. She doesn't know Hannah's name or what classes I've taken, or if I've been sleeping. But she will only have to take one look at my face to know how I'm doing. I take everything off my bulletin board and carry the papers down the hall to the bathroom in the other wing, where I scatter them into the trash. There will be no way to fool her. The elevator doors open, but I don't step inside. I don't know why I've never worried about the elevators before. Now in the daylight, so close to Mabel's arrival, I realize that if they were to break, if I were to get stuck inside alone, and if my phone weren't able to get service, and no one was on the other end of the call button, I would be trapped for a long time before the groundskeeper might think to check on me. Days, at least. Mabel would arrive and no one would let her in. She would pound at the door and not even I would hear her. Eventually, she would get back in her cab and wait at the airport until she found a flight to take her home. She would think it was almost predictable that I would disappoint her, that I would refuse to be seen. So I watch as the doors close again, and then I head to the stairs. The cab I called waits outside, engine idling, and I make a crushed ice trail from the dorm lobby, thankful for Hannah's spare pair of boots, which are only a tiny bit small, and which she forced on me when the first snow fell. "You have no idea," she told me. The cab driver steps out to open my door. I nod my thanks.
Where to?
He asks, once we're both inside with the heat going strong, breathing the stale cologne and coffee air.
Stop and Shop, I say.
My first words in 24 hours. The fluorescent grocery store lights, all the shoppers and their carts, the crying babies, the Christmas music. It would be too much if I didn't know exactly what to buy. But the shopping part is easy. Microwave popcorn with extra butter flavor, thin stick pretzels, milk chocolate truffles, instant hot chocolate, grapefruit-flavored sparkling water. When I climb back into the cab, I have 3 heavy bags full of food, enough to last us a week, even though she'll only be here 3 days. The communal kitchen is on the 2nd floor. I live on the 3rd, and I've never used it. I think of it as the place girls in clubs bake brownies for movie nights, or a gathering spot for groups of friends who feel like cooking an occasional dinner as a break from the dining hall. I open the refrigerator to discover it empty. It must have been cleaned out for the break. Instructions tell us to label all of our items with our initials, room number, and date. Even though I'm the only one here, I reach for the Sharpie and masking tape. Soon, food labeled as mine fills 2 of the 3 shelves. Upstairs in my room, I assemble the snacks on Hannah's desk. It looks abundant, just as I'd hoped. And then my phone buzzes with a text. I'm here. It isn't even 6 o'clock yet. I should still have a half hour at least, and I can't help but torture myself by scrolling up to see all of the texts Mabel sent before this one, asking if I'm okay, saying she's thinking of me, wondering where the fuck am I, whether I'm angry, if we can talk, if she can visit, if I miss her. Remember Nebraska? One of them says, a reference to a plan we never intended to keep. They go on, a series of unanswered messages that seize me with guilt, until I'm snapped out of it by the phone ringing in my hand. I startle. Answer it.
Hey,
she says. It's the first time I've heard her voice since everything happened.
I'm downstairs and it's fucking freezing. Let me in?
And then I am at the lobby door. We are separated by only a sheet of glass and my shaking hand as I reach to turn the lock. I touch the metal and pause to look at her. She's blowing into her hands to warm them. She's faced away from me. And then she turns, and our eyes meet. And I don't know how I ever thought I'd be able to smile. I can barely turn the latch.
I don't know how anyone can live anywhere this cold,
she says as I pull open the door, and she steps inside. It's freezing down here, too. I say, my room is warmer. I reach for one of her bags carefully, so our fingers don't touch. I'm grateful for the weight of it as we ride the elevator up. The walk down the hallway is silent, and then we get to my door, and once inside, she sets down her suitcase, shrugs off her coat. Here is Mabel, in my room, 3,000 miles away from what used to be home. She sees the snacks I bought, each one of them something she loves.
So, she says, I guess it's okay that I came?
Chapter 2 Mabel is finally warm enough. She tosses her hat onto Hannah's bed, unwraps her red and yellow scarf. I flinch at the familiarity of them. All of my clothes are new.
I'd make you give me a tour, but there's no way I'm going back out there, she says.
Yeah. Sorry about that, I say, still fixed to her scarf and hat. Are they as soft as they used to be?
You're apologizing for the weather?
Her eyebrows are raised. Her tone is teasing. But when I can't think of anything witty to say back, her question hovers in the room, a reminder of the apology she's really come for. 3,000 miles is a long way to travel to hear someone say she's sorry.
So what are your professors like?
Thankfully, I managed to tell her about my history professor, who swears during lessons, rides a motorcycle, and seems much more like someone you'd meet at a bar than in a lecture hall. This topic doesn't make me a gifted conversationalist, but at least it makes me adequate.
At first I kept thinking all my professors were celibate, I say.
She laughs. I made her laugh.
But then I met this guy, and he shattered the illusion.
What building is his class in? We can do a window tour.
Her back is to me as she peers out at my school. I take a moment too long before joining her.
Mabel. In New York. In my room.
Outside, the snow covers the ground and the benches, the hood of the groundskeeper's truck and the trees. Lights on the pathways glow even though nobody's here. It looks even emptier this way. So much light and only stillness.
Over there? I point across the night to the furthermost building, barely lit up.
And where's your lit class?
Right here.
I point to the building next to us.
What else are you taking?
I show her the gym where I swim laps every morning and try, unsuccessfully, to master the butterfly stroke. I swim late at night, too, but I don't tell her that. The pool is always 80 degrees. Diving in feels like plunging into nothing, not the icy shock I've known forever. No waves cold enough to numb me or strong enough to pull me under. At night, the pool is quiet, and I swim laps and then just float, watching the ceiling, or closing my eyes, all the sounds foggy and distant, the lifeguard keeping watch. It helps me get calm when the panic starts. But when it's too late at night and the pool is closed and I can't stop my thoughts, it's Hannah who can steady me.
I just read the most interesting thing, she'll say from her bed, her textbook resting in her lap.
And then she reads to me about honeybees, about deciduous trees, about evolution. It takes me a while, usually, to be able to listen. But when I do, I discover the secrets of pollination, that honeybees' wings beat 200 times per second, that trees shed their leaves not according to season, but according to rainfall, that before all of us, there was something else. Eventually, something will take our place. I learn that I am a tiny piece of a miraculous world. I make myself understand again that I am in a dorm room at a college, that what happened has happened. It's over. Doubt pushes in, but I use our twin beds and desks and closets, the four walls around us, the girls who neighbor us on both sides, and the ones who neighbor them, the whole building, and the campus, and the state of New York, to fend doubt off. We are what's real, I tell myself as I fall asleep. Then, at 6 a.m., when the pool opens, I go swimming. A movement calls me back, Mabel, tucking her hair behind her ear.
Where is the dining hall? She asks.
You can't see it from this window, but it's across the courtyard in the back.
What's it like?
Decent.
I mean the people. The scene.
Pretty mellow. I usually sit with Hannah and her friends.
Hannah?
My roommate. Do you see the building with the pointy roof? Behind those trees? She nods. That's where my anthropology class is. It's probably my favorite.
Really?
Not lit?
I nod.
Because of the professors?
No, they're both good,
I say. Everything in lit is just too ambiguous, I guess.
But that's what you like. All the difference is in interpretation.
Is that true? I can't remember. I shrug. But you're still an English major.
No, I'm undeclared now, I say. But I'm pretty sure I'm going to switch to natural sciences.
I think I see a flash of annoyance cross her face, but then she smiles at me.
Bathroom? She asks.
Follow me. I lead her around the corner, then return to my room. 3 days suddenly feels so long. Unfathomable, all the minutes Mabel and I will need to fill. But then I see her scarf on the bed, her hat next to it. I pick them up. They're even softer than I remembered, and they smell like the rose water Mabel and her mom spray everywhere. On themselves and in their cars, in all the bright rooms of their house. I hold on to them, and keep holding even when I hear Mabel's footsteps approach. I breathe in the rose, the earthiness of Mabel's skin, all the hours we spent in her house. 3 days will never be enough.
I have to call my parents, Mabel says from the doorway. I set down her things. If she noticed me holding them, she isn't going to acknowledge it.
I texted them from the airport, but they're so nervous about this. They kept giving me tips about driving in the snow. I kept saying, I'm not going to be the one driving.
She puts her phone to her ear, but even from across the room, I can hear when they answer, both Anna's voice and Javier's, exuberant and relieved. The briefest fantasy. Mabel appears at the doorway, catches sight of me. She sits next to me on the bed, takes the hat and sets it down, takes the scarf from my hands and wraps it around my neck, takes my hands and warms them in hers.
Yes, she says. The plane was fine. I don't know, it was pretty big.
No, they didn't serve food. She looks at me.
Yes, she says. Marin's right here.
Will they ask to talk to me?
I have to go check on something, I tell her. Say hi for me.
I slip out the door and down the stairs to the kitchen. I open the refrigerator. Everything is exactly as I left it, neatly labeled and arranged. We could make ravioli and garlic bread, quesadillas with beans and rice on the side, vegetable soup, a spinach salad with dried cranberries and blue cheese, or chili with cornbread. I spend long enough away that by the time I get back, Mabel has hung up.
Chapter 3 May.
I slept through my alarm, woke to Gramps singing to me from the living room. A song about a sailor dreaming, about Marin, his sailor girl. His accent was slight. He'd lived in San Francisco since he was 9, but when he sang, he became unmistakably Irish. He tapped on my door, sang a verse loudly just outside. Mine was the front bedroom, overlooking the street, while Gramps occupied 2 rooms in the back of the house. Between us were the living room and dining room and kitchen, so we could pretty much do whatever we wanted without fear that the other would be listening. He never came into my room. I never went into his. That might sound unfriendly, but it wasn't. We spent plenty of time together in the in-between rooms, reading on the sofa and the easy chair, playing cards in the dining room, cooking together, eating at the round kitchen table, so small that we never had to ask the other to pass the salt, and our knees bumped so often we didn't bother apologizing. Our hampers were in the hall by the bathroom, and we took turns doing laundry, leaving neatly folded stacks on the dining room table for the other to take whenever the time was right. Maybe parents or spouses would have taken the clothes and opened up the other one's drawers, but we were not father and daughter. We were not spouses. And in our house, we enjoyed our togetherness, but we enjoyed our apartness, too. His song trailed off as I opened my door to his wide-knuckled, age-spotted hand, holding out coffee in the yellow mug.
"You'll need a ride today,"
And from the looks of you, you'll need this coffee.
Yellow morning light, beating through the curtains. Blonde hair in my eyes until I pushed it away. A few minutes later, we were in the car. The news was all about a prisoner of war who had been brought back, and Gramps kept saying,
"What a shame. Such a young boy."
And I was glad he had something to engage himself, because I was thinking about last night. About Mabel, and all of our other friends, cross-legged in the sand, part shadowed, part lit in the bonfire glow. It was May already. We'd all be leaving one another, going to other places in the fall, and now that the season was changing, rushing toward graduation, everything we did felt like a long goodbye or a premature reunion. We were nostalgic for a time that wasn't yet over.
"So young,"
Gramps was saying.
"To endure a thing like that, and people can be so heartless."
He set his blinker on as we approached the drop-off zone at Convent. I held my coffee cup out so it wouldn't slosh as he turned.
"Look at that,"
he said, pointing at the dashboard clock.
2 minutes to spare."
"You're my hero," I told him.
"You be good,"
he said.
"And careful. Don't let the sisters know we're heathens."
He grinned. I took my last sips. "I won't."
"Take an extra helping of the blood of Christ for me, will you?"
I rolled my eyes, set my empty mug on the seat. I shut the door and leaned down to wave at him, still delighted by his own jokes, through the rolled-up window. He made his face fake somber and crossed himself before laughing and driving away. In English, we were talking about ghosts, about whether they were there at all, and if they were, whether they were as evil as the governess in the Turn of the Screw thought.
"Here are two statements," Sister Josephine said.
"One, the governess is hallucinating. Two, the ghosts are real." She turned and wrote both on the board. "Find evidence in the novel for both of these. Tomorrow, we'll discuss as a class." My hand shot up. "I have a third idea."
"Oh?"
"The staff is conspiring against her, an elaborate trick." Sister Josephine smiled.
"Intriguing theory,"
Mabel said. "It's complicated enough with two," and a few other people agreed with her. "It's better if it's complicated," I said. Mabel turned in her desk to face me.
"Wait, excuse me? It's better if it's complicated?"
"Of course it is. It's the point of the novel. We can search for the truth. We can convince ourselves of whatever we want to believe, but we'll never actually know. I guarantee that we can find evidence to argue that the staff is playing a trick on the governess." Sister Josephine said,
"I'll add it to the list."
After school, Mabel and I split up our science assignment on the 31, hopped off around the corner from Trouble Coffee, and went in to celebrate our excellent time management with two cappuccinos. "I keep thinking about ghosts," I said as we walked alongside the pastel houses with flat facades and square windows. "They show up in all my favorite books." "Final essay topic?" I nodded. "But I have to figure out a thesis. The only thing I like about The Turn of the Screw is the governess's first sentence." Mabel paused to tug on her sandal strap. I closed my eyes and felt the sun on my face. I said, "I remember the whole beginning as a succession of flights and drops, a little seesaw of the right throbs and the wrong."
"Of course you would know it by heart."
"Well,
it's amazing. I thought the whole thing would be that way, but it's just confusing and pointless. The ghosts, if there are ghosts, don't even do anything. They just show up and stand around." I opened our iron gate and we climbed the stairs to the landing. Gramps was calling hello before we'd even closed the door behind us. We set down our coffees, shrugged off our backpacks, and went straight to the kitchen. His hands were covered in flour. Wednesdays were his favorite, because there were two of us to bake for.
"Smells delicious," Mabel said.
Say it in Spanish, Gramps said.
Huele delicioso. What is it?
Mabel said.
Chocolate bundt cake. Now say, the chocolate bundt cake smells delicious.
Gramps, I said, you're exoticizing her again. He lifted his hands, busted.
I can't help it if I want to hear some words in a beautiful language.
She laughed and said the sentence, and many other sentences, with only a few words I understood, and Gramps wiped his hands on his apron and then touched them to his heart.
Beautiful, he said. Hermosa.
And then he headed out of the kitchen and saw something that made him stop.
Girls, please sit.
Uh-oh, the love seat, Mabel whispered.
We crossed to the faded red love seat and sat together, waiting to discover the subject of that afternoon's lecture.
Girls,
he said again,
we have to talk about this.
He picked up one of the to-go cups that we'd set on the coffee table, held it with disdain.
When I was growing up, none of this stuff was here. Trouble coffee. Who names an establishment Trouble? A bar, sure, maybe. But a cafe? No. Mabel's parents and I spend good money to send you girls to a nice school. Now you want to stand in lines to buy lunch and spend far too much on a cup of coffee. How much did this cost?
$4, I said.
Four? Each?
He shook his head.
Let me offer you a helpful piece of advice. That is $3 more than a cup of coffee should be.
It's a cappuccino.
He sniffed the cup.
They can call it whatever they want to call it. I have a perfectly good pot in the kitchen and some beans that are fresh enough for anyone.
I rolled my eyes, but Mabel was ardent in her respect for elders.
It was a splurge, she said. But you're right.
$4?
Come on, Gramps. I smell the cake. Shouldn't you check on it?
You're a sly girl,
he said to me.
No, I said. Only hungry.
And I was. It was torture to wait for the cake to cool, but when it did, we devoured it.
Save a sliver for the fellas,
Gramps implored us. But for four old guys, his friends were the pickiest eaters I'd ever known. Like the girls at school, they were off gluten one week, only to suddenly be on it again if the meal was enticing enough. They were laying off sugar or carbs or caffeine or meat or dairy, but maybe a little butter was fine now and then. When they broke their own rules, they complained about it, took bites of Gramps' sweets and declared them too sugary.
They don't deserve this cake, I said between bites. They won't appreciate it like we do. Maybe you should mail a piece to Birdie. Overnight it. Does she know about your baking? Mabel asked him.
I may have mentioned it once or twice.
One bite of this and she'll be yours forever, Mabel said.
Gramps shook his head and laughed, and Mabel and I were soon stuffed and happy, traipsing back out as Jones, the first of Gramps's buddies, arrived, holding his lucky card deck in one hand and his cane in the other. I took a minute to talk to him.
Agnes is having surgery on her hand again Tuesday, he told me.
Do you guys need any help with anything?
Samantha's taking some days off from the salon, he said.
Maybe I'll come by and say hi.
Samantha was Jones and Agnes's daughter, and she'd been so nice to me in the months I lived with them, when I was 8 and Gramps had to spend some time in the hospital. She drove me to school and back every day, and even after Gramps came home, she helped us, picking up his new prescriptions and making sure we had food in the house.
She'd love to see you.
All right, I said. We're headed to the beach. Try to hold on to your money.
Mabel and I walked the 4 blocks to the beach. We slipped off our sandals where the road met the sand and carried them up a dune, weaving through patches of beach grass and the green and rust-colored ice plants. We sat at a safe distance from the water, while the flocks of gray and white sanderlings pecked at the shore. At first it looked like no one was out there, but I knew to watch and to wait. And soon I saw them, a pair of surfers in the distance, now mounting their boards to catch a wave. We watched them against the horizon line,
rising and falling. An hour passed, and we lost sight of them over and over, and each time found them again.
"I'm cold," Mabel said when the fog set in.
I scooted closer to her until the sides of our bodies touched. She gave me her hands, and I rubbed them until we were warm. She wanted to go home, but the surfers were still in the water. We stayed until they reached the sand, tucked their boards under their arms, turquoise and gold against their wetsuits. I waited to see if one of them would know me. They got closer, a man and a woman, both squinting to see if I was who they thought I'd be.
"Hey, Marin,"
the man said. I lifted my hand. "Marin, I have something for you." The woman unzipped her backpack and pulled out a shell. "Claire's favorite kind," she said, pressing it into my palm. Then they were past us, making their way to the parking lot.
"You haven't asked me what I'm writing about," Mabel said.
The shell was wide and pink, covered in ridges. Dozens like it filled three large mason jars in my bedroom, all of them gifts. She held out her hand, and I dropped it in.
"Jane Eyre, Flora and Miles, basically everyone in a mercy."
She ran her thumb over the shell's ridges and then gave it back. She looked at me. "Orphans," she said.
Gramps never spoke about my mother, but he didn't have to. All I had to do was stop by the surf shop or show up at the beach at dawn, and I'd be handed free mollusk shirts and thermoses full of tea. When I was a kid, my mom's old friends liked to wrap their arms around me, pet my hair. They squinted in my direction as I approached and beckoned me toward them on the sand. I didn't know all of their names, but every one of them knew mine.
I guess when you spend a life riding waves, knowing that the ocean is heartless and millions of times stronger than you are, but still trusting that you're skilled enough or brave enough or charmed enough to survive it, you become indebted to the people who don't make it. Someone always dies. It's just a matter of who and when. You remember her with songs, with shrines of shells and flowers and beach glass, with an arm around her daughter, and later, daughters of your own named after her. She didn't actually die in the ocean. She died at Laguna Honda Hospital, a gash on her head, her lungs full of water. I was almost three. Sometimes I think I can remember a warmth, a closeness, a feeling of being in arms, maybe. Soft hair against my cheek. There is nothing to remember of my father. He was a traveler, back somewhere in Australia before the pregnancy test.
"If only he knew about you," Gramps would say when I was little and wondering. "You would be his treasure."
I thought of the grief as simple. Quiet. One photograph of Claire hung in the hallway. Sometimes I caught Gramps looking at it. Sometimes I stood in front of it for several minutes at a time, studying her face and her body, finding hints of myself in her, imagining that I must have been nearby, playing in the sand or lying on a blanket, wondering if, when I was 22, my smile would be anywhere close to that pretty. Once in a meeting at convent, the counselor asked Gramps if he talked about my mother with me.
"Remembering the departed is the only way to heal," she said.
Gramps's eyes lost their sparkle. His mouth became a tight line.
"Just a reminder,"
the counselor said more quietly, then turned to the computer screen to get back to the matter of my unexcused absences.
"Sister,"
Gramps said, his voice low and venomous.
"I lost my wife when she was 46. I lost my daughter when she was 24. And you remind me to remember them?"
"Mr. Delaney," she said, "I am truly sorry for your loss. Both of your losses. I will pray for your healing,
but my concern here is for Marin, and all I ask is that you share some of your memories with her.
My body went tense. We were called in because they were concerned about my academic progress, but I was getting A's or B's in all my classes, and all they had on me was that I'd cut a couple periods. Now I realized that this meeting was actually about a story I'd written, a story in English about a girl raised by sirens. The sirens were guilt-ridden over murdering the girl's mother, so they told the girl stories about her, made her as real as they could, but there was always a hollowness to the girl that they couldn't fill. She was always wondering. It was only a story, but sitting in the counselor's office, I realized I should have known better. I should have written about a prince raised by wolves after he lost his father to the woods or whatever, something less transparent, because teachers always thought everything was a cry for help. And young, nice teachers like Sister Josephine were the worst. I knew I had to change the subject or the counselor would start talking about my story. "I'm really sorry about the classes I missed, okay?" I said. "It was poor judgment. I got too swept up in my social life." The counselor nodded. "May I count on you not to do this again?" she asked. "You have before school and after school, the lunch period, evenings, weekends. The majority of your hours are free to spend however you and your grandfather see fit, but during class periods we expect..."
"Sister,"
Gramps said, his voice a growl again, as if he hadn't heard anything we'd been saying.
"I'm sure that painful things have happened to you. Even marrying Jesus can't entirely shield you from the realities of life. I ask you now to take a moment to remember those terrible things. I remind you now to remember them. There. Don't you feel healed? Maybe you should tell us about them. Don't you feel so much better? Do they fill you with fondness? Do you find yourself joyful?
Mr. Delaney, please.
Would you care to dazzle us with a tale of redemption?
All right, I can see.
Would you like to sing a song of joy for us now?
I apologize for upsetting you, but this is... Gramps stood, puffed out his chest.
Yes, he said. This is entirely inappropriate of me. Almost as inappropriate as a nun offering counsel regarding the deaths of a spouse and a child. Marin is getting excellent grades. Marin is an excellent student.
The counselor leaned back in her office chair, stoic.
And Marin, Gramps said, triumphant, is coming with me.
He turned and swung open the door. Bye, I said as apologetically as I could. He stormed out. I followed him. The car ride home was a one-man comedy act comprised of every nun joke Gramps could remember. I laughed at the punchlines until he didn't really need me anymore. It was a monologue. When it was over, I asked him if he'd heard from Birdie today, and he smiled.
"You write two letters, you get two letters," he said.
And then I thought of the tears in Sister Josephine's eyes when I was reading my story to the class, how she thanked me for being so brave. And okay, maybe it wasn't entirely imagined. Maybe the sirens gave the girl shells that filled her underwater room. Maybe the story came from some part of me that wished I knew more, or at least had actual memories instead of feelings that may have only been inventions.
Chapter 4. Mabel is learning as much about Hannah as our room can tell her. The pile of papers on her desk, her immaculate bedmaking, the signed posters from Broadway shows, and her bright plush comforter. "Where's she from?"
"Manhattan."
"This is the prettiest blue," Mabel says, admiring the Persian rug between our beds, worn enough to show its age, but still soft underfoot. She stands in front of the bulletin board asking me about the people in the photographs. Megan from down the hall, Davis, her ex-boyfriend who is still her friend, some girls also from home whose names I don't remember. She likes quotes, Mabel says. I nod. She reads a lot. This Emerson quote is everywhere. I saw it on a magnet. Which one? Finish each day and be done with it. You have done what you could. Some blunders and absurdities no doubt crept in. Forget them as soon as you can. I can see why. Who doesn't need to be reminded of that? Yeah, I guess so, Mabel says. Hannah's really like that, I say. Things don't seem to get to her. She's kind of straightforward, I guess. But in the best way. In a way that's really smart and kind. So you like her? Yeah, I like her a lot. Great, she says. But I can't tell if she means it. Okay, let's move on to you. What kind of plant is this? A peperomia. I got it at a plant sale on campus, and I've kept it alive for 3 months. Impressive, right? Good job. I know. We smile at each other. It feels almost natural between us. These are nice bowls, she says, taking one off my windowsill. Besides the photograph of my mother that lives in a folder in my closet, the bowls are the best things I own. They're a perfect shade of yellow, not too bright, and I know where they came from and who made them. I like how substantial they are, how you can feel the weight of the clay. One of the first lectures my history professor gave us was about this guy William Morris. He said that everything you own should be either useful or beautiful. It's a lot to aspire to, but I figured why not try. I saw these in a potter's studio a couple days afterward, and I bought them. They're so pretty. They make everything feel kind of special. Even cereal and ramen, I say, which are both major components of my diet. Pillars of nutrition. What do you eat at school? My dorms are different, like mini apartments. We have 3 rooms and then a common space with a living room and kitchen. 6 of us share it, so we cook lots of big batches of things. My roommate makes the best lasagna. I have no idea how it's as good as it is. She just uses pre-shredded cheese and bottled sauce. At least she has that going for her. What do you mean? She asks. Before she gave up on me, Mabel sent me a litany of reasons not to like her roommate. Her terrible taste in music. Her loud snoring. Her tumultuous love life and messiness and ugly decorations. Remind me why you didn't join me in sunny Southern California, she wrote. And also, please, come make this girl disappear and steal her identity. Oh, she says now, remembering. Right. Well, it's been a while. She's grown on me. She turns to see what else she can comment on, but the plant and bowls are the extent of my furnishings. I'm planning on getting more stuff soon, I say. I just need to find a job first. Concern flashes across her face. Do you have... I can't believe I never thought about this. Do you have any money? Yeah, I say. Don't worry. He left me some, just not that much. I mean enough for now, but I have to be careful. What about tuition? He had already paid for this year. But what about the next 3 years? This shouldn't be so difficult to talk about. This part should be easy. My counselor here says we should be able to make it work, with loans and financial aid and scholarships. She says as long as I do well, we should be able to figure it out. Okay, she says. That sounds good, I guess. But she still looks concerned. So, I say, you're here for 3 nights, right? She nods. I thought maybe tomorrow or the next day we could take the bus to the shopping district. There isn't too much there, but there's the studio where I bought those bowls and a restaurant and a few other shops. Yeah, sounds fun. She's staring at the rug now, not yet back to herself. Marin, she says, I should just tell you now that I'm here with a motive, not for vacation.